Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, November 15th, the Grandma's Baggage Edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm the editorial director of Slate Podcasts, and I'm the father of Leo, who is 4, and Eliza, who is 7.
I'm Rebecca Lavoy. I'm a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 17, Teddy, who is 15 and a half, and my stepdaughter, Lily, who is 18.
And I'm Carvo Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I'm the father to Georgia, who is 13, and Ezra, who is 15.
Today on our show, we have a question from a mother who is fed up trying to work around her husband's night shift schedule, and another about a 3-year-old who is being a jerk to his grandma. Plus, as always, we're going to have triumphs and fails. We're going to have recommendations on Slate Plus. Will Oremus will join us to present a classic parenting conundrum. What do you do with a sick kid when both parents have to work? To hear that segment, you should be a member of Slate Plus. First, let's do triumphs and fails. Rebecca, triumph, fail, what do you got?
I've got a triumph. And full disclosure, I've been saving this one because I felt really bad about rolling it out on one of Carvel's fail weeks where he talked about Ezra and school and his interventions and so forth, because Teddy, it seems, is turning this shit around. I had his parent-teacher conference a couple weeks ago, and it was the very first time in the history of parent-teacher conferences that involved my son, Teddy Lavoy, where I left the building feeling fantastic in every regard. He is doing fine. His grades are like in the, 80s or whatever. And it's so easy to say. And I'm totally doing my best to let all this other stuff go about like what he could be doing and his potential and so forth. But I'm just like, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's found a baseline. He's hit a groove. All of his teacher says he's a pleasure to have in class. He participates. He's not missing all of his assignments. He's missing like one or two here or there. He actually asked to retake a test that he didn't do well on and retook it and did fine. And this has really been independent of any other kind of intervention on our part. You know, we set him up with tutoring last year. He still goes once a week, but only for a very short period of time, just to sort of check in with somebody who's helping him with making sure his assignments are done. But because he's so busy doing driver's ed and the play, he's missed a bunch of tutoring sessions. It seems, and this is the word from his teachers, feels like he's enjoying being at school and seems like he's just doing the minimum, like showing up at his job and doing his job. And, you know, is he like going to be the president of the Honor Society? No. But for me, he is the president of the Honor Society just in this feedback, just in hearing that, like, he seems happy, he's engaging, everybody seems to think that he's actually participating. I don't know. It was just really great. And I'm sure it sounds like I'm a crazy person for just being like, oh, your kid is doing what they're supposed to do. It's a triumph. But it really is. And if you've ever attended any of the previous parent-teacher conferences I've had over the years that have really been exercises in really like a difficult kind of frustration and just like, we know your son is smart, but he doesn't do X, Y, or Z. It just feels really good to leave the building feeling like good. And that's what happened. And I don't know, I'm just really feeling fantastic about it. And I'm so happy for Teddy. Most of all, it's his triumph. He owns it. And I can't say I've done anything differently this year other than completely take my foot off the gas. And if you're in a situation like I've been all these years, that I guess is a tactic worth trying to do. Take your foot off the gas. Stop trying to make things happen. Just let them fail or succeed on their own terms. And sometimes, I guess, kids are capable of just starting to figure it out, which is where he is right now.
That's great. That does seem like good advice.
Yeah, I agree with that advice 100%. I mean, yes, that's been my experience too, is that you, at a certain point, you have to take your foot off the gas just because having it on there isn't making anything happen anymore. It's just creating a lot. You know what I mean? It might not be that taking it off is making anything happen, but like, it's not having it on isn't making anything happen either. And you're just like exerting unnecessary force and energy and damaging your relationship with your loved one. And at a certain point, you just kind of gotta like let the chips fall where they may.
You're flooding the engine. You gotta take your foot off the gas. Pull out the choke.
I was gonna try and go deep on the car metaphors, and then I was like, none of us need that.
It's also possible you have a faulty alternator. You might want to take that in and have somebody look at it. I'm not sure what that would be in metaphorical terms. And I don't know anything else about cars.
Sometimes your bushing is damaged. You just don't know. You know.
No idea. Oh, might be overheated radiator. I think that's a thing that can happen sometimes.
CV joints, guys. Yeah, it's the CV joints.
Could be. I have a fail. It's a slightly like Rebecca's. This one is from a couple weeks ago. I had some more spectacular fails more recently, but this one is from Halloween season. During Halloween season, of course, there's a lot of talk about spooky monsters, and my kids are very interested in watching cartoons about monsters and seeing Mickey Mouse meet the monsters and then get scared for a minute and then not be scared anymore because they're friendly monsters or whatever. In any case, Eliza was asking me some question, and she said that, why does Frankenstein have bolts in his head or something like that? And I wasn't thinking. I was paying attention to something else, and I just reflexively said to her, actually, his name is Frankenstein's monster. And I saw the look.
What a douche.
I saw the look on her face. The look at first of dismay at having gotten something wrong and being corrected, and then secondly of being in possession of a piece of knowledge that meant that most people around you are wrong. And I knew that I had set her on the bad path that I myself have been struggling with for my entire life. And I said, but it's really important that you don't become a person who corrects other people about that the way I just did. Oh, do as I say, it's not as I do. And I don't know if I got it across. And I'm pretty sure that she's going to be correcting all of her classmates about how you should refer to Frankenstein's monster for the rest of time.
What you should do, though, is teach her how important it is to say, but actually, before but
actually,
she actually, shares the this
key
knowledge.
The part is the actually.
The thing is, I know better, but there's some that the part of me that still does. I need to be paying attention all the time to make sure I don't do shit like that. It's so terrible.
Yeah, I mean, you defaulted to, you know, I mean, it happened. It's in us.
In an unguarded moment, we reveal who we really are. And that's what I did.
The truth of who we are. We are nerd mansplainers.
That's who we are.
We are. Actually.
So terrible. All right. Carvel, how about you? Triumph or fail?
I have a fail. I feel like I've been thinking a lot about triumphs and fails lately, and how, like, I know that we do fails because we know that parents always feel like they're messing up and we don't want anyone to feel like they're alone. But then lately I've been thinking about why, like, maybe I should just have a positive outlook on what I'm doing and, you know, and like think of everything as a triumph, even the things we're struggling with. And I was thinking that. But then I had this week, which reminded me, oh no, that's actually like a fail. So people know that we're having these wildfires in California and they're terrible. Like, they're really bad. And one of the pieces of them that's really bad is that the air quality in the Bay Area is horrific. The air quality index on Friday in Oakland was something like 180 something. By comparison, the air quality index in New York City today is like 53. And that's 180, that's parts per million of like non-good, bad shit in the air that you shouldn't be breathing. it's like there's particles, there's carbon monoxide, there's nitrogen, and then there's ozone. Those are all the things they measure, and there's a bunch of that stuff in the air because of the fires. And they say that after 151, it's like a risk, like you shouldn't really be outside in general. And so on Friday, we were like at 180 something, and it was really bad. And one of the things about like watching this whole thing happen is that we collectively engage in these huge levels of denial. Like people are still jogging. Like I'm at the lake and people are jogging. And I'm like, why? Why are they jogging? Because like we have this thing where we're like, nope, nothing's, everything's fine. Like there's not a problem here. It's like, meanwhile, literally there are enough particles in the air to damage your lungs permanently, and people are still out engaging in strenuous exercise. It's a weird phenomenon that I've observed and kind of been troubled by over the, and like none of the, no one wants to close anything. Schools weren't canceled. Monday was Veterans Day. Anyway, but so there's just this weird thing where people continue to try and like go forward knowing that they shouldn't, because no one wants to admit that there's a problem. And that's how we got in the situation in the first place. So I've on Friday was like, was making the classic mistake of being like, it smells like a campfire. It's not ideal, but I'm sure it's fine. And then over the weekend, I had a bunch of friends of mine posting stuff on Instagram and like just being adamant, like, actually, this is not fine. This is really serious. You shouldn't be out breathing this. You definitely need to be wearing a mask. And I was doing like the old like thing of being like, people who are wearing masks are being ridiculous. Like we just walk it off, you know, just like I like reverted to my old like Southwestern Pennsylvania steel town, just walk it off approach to everything. And but then as the weekend progressed, I started realizing, well, wait a second. So then I started Googling and like doing all this research and I was like, hold up, this is actually terrible. Like why? So then I was like, I should get masks and the kids should have masks. Like, what are we doing? And for the most part, the kids were fine. Ezra did walk home from school on Friday and he thought it was really cool looking the way the light was all like weird and because it's smoky and hazy and all that. But like it's like a 25 minute walk home from school in an air quality index of like 180 something. It's like not good. So Monday they don't have school because they go to public schools. And then Tuesday comes along, and on Monday, a friend of mine texts me and is like, so there's only this one mask that you should use. All the other masks are basically bullshit. So, of course, all the masks that you can use got sold out within the first, like, 2-3 days of the fires. So Tuesday comes along, and I'm like, everyone should be wearing masks. And so on Monday, a friend of mine texted me like, oh, I was able to get these masks. Some friend ordered this from out of state. We have a box. Do you want some for you and your kids? I was like, yes. So I go to my friend's house. I get the masks. And then I go to Georgia was already at school, but I go to get Ezra. And I'm like, dude, I have these masks. You should wear one. And he's like, Dad, I don't need a mask. And I'm like, no, you totally need one. These are the numbers. This is the mathematics of it. He's like, Dad, don't you think you're being a little ridiculous? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm like sitting there wearing a mask. I'm like, no, I'm not being ridiculous. This is permanent damage. He's like, Dad, what does that mean, permanent damage? And we get into this fight and he just won't believe me. And I'm like Googling stuff and I'm showing him numbers. And he's like, I mean, I'll take the mask, but I'm not going to wear it because it looks stupid. And I realized I had no way of convincing him, like none, that this was serious. Like, even though it, because I just learned it was serious like a day earlier. And so, like, my whole life I've been modeling this behavior of like, it's fine, don't overreact, walk it off. And then I finally get woke about one thing. And then the next day I try to like convince my son that it's serious and he just won't hear it. I ended up giving him the mask, but I don't think he's wearing it. He walked to school this morning and I just was like, it just was this weird thing where I felt completely powerless. And I remembered I used to have arguments with my mother like this when I was a teenager. She would say something was serious and I'd be like, Mom, really? That's just the news trying to stress you out. Like, that's just ridiculous. And like, just that unwavering obnoxiousness of adolescence, my own kid was doing it. And it was around something that I thought was relatively serious. Today, the air quality index, or yesterday, it was 167. Today, it's better. It's at 149, which is technically okay, quote unquote, according to the federal standards, which always end up being wrong later. And it's just like this super stressful thing. And I felt like I had no way to convince him to take it seriously. And I still haven't been able to. So that's my fail. I don't know what the right thing to do would have been, but I'm just aware that I'm powerless to like convince my son that this is serious. And the reason I'm talking about him is that Georgia mostly gets it. She's also, her school's not making her go outside. So she kind of gets to school. She doesn't walk to school. I drive her to school. She goes to school. She like, you know, she's inside, but Ezra's the one who has this long walk to and from school and he just refuses to wear a mask during it. So I don't know.
It feels like it'll be basically impossible to change his mind until, like, every other kid in his high school is wearing the masks. Like, right. Like what you're fighting against is like the adolescent desire not to do anything that will make you look very weird to people around you, which that's a really powerful force that you're fighting against.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, it's also like that was the thing that because he kept saying, because like literally you walk outside and only one of every 10 people is wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And so it really is like this tremendous distraction, the fact that no one is taking it seriously, even though it's like it seems like it's pretty serious. But everyone's sort of like, I don't feel anything. I don't smell anything. It seems fine. It's like the most accurate example of like our culture's weird like hang up on ignoring things until they become so bad you can't ignore them. It's like that's what I feel like I'm watching happening, and it's really frustrating.
It's also like it's a microcosm too of like the unregulated landscape. I mean, when I was very little, like there was no seatbelt law. There were cars that didn't have seatbelts, right. And then it became a law, and now everybody has them. And argument against wearing seatbelts is like
absolutely.
They're not cool and they mess up my clothes. Like that was like
totally.
The legit reason why people didn't use them. And then it became a law, and no one is saying like that's a terrible law, but
right.
People do say like we shouldn't have all these regulations. Like we don't need them.
Right.
We need to make choices. Yeah. Well, sometimes it's also good to not be thrown out of your car if your car crashes.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I know that in other countries that just the use of masks is just much more accepted, you know. It's just
right.
Very different here. In our,
yeah.
Our
and I mean,
cool.
People aren't going to want to, like, admit that there's a major, because, like, wearing masks is, like, that's, like, dystopian future, and nobody wants to, like, truly admit dystopian future-looking stuff that's aesthetically, it's too dystopian, no one wants it. But I'm just like, it's not going to be this way forever. Like, there are wildfires. The air is screwy. You can look at it mathematically and see. It's not like a secret. And so while the air quality index is like in the 140s, 50s, and 60s, wear a freaking mask. Like, why is that even a thing? But
and why is Ezra like not able to just take the mask, tell you he's wearing it, and then just not wear it like a normal kid would? I mean,
well, he sort of, because he like, he can't, he's not, he doesn't like to lie. I mean, if he doesn't believe in something, he'll let you know, which I appreciate about that about him.
I think he'd have to be pretty scared of his dad to want to lie rather than to use it as an opportunity to demonstrate that he knows much better than his stupid dad with his stupid mask.
That's right. He wants to engage in debate with me. He wants to argue me down.
Yeah, totally. Great. Lucky you. Lucky
yeah,
you.
I know. Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Before we move on, let's do the business. As always, if you have a question that you would like us to tackle, you can leave us a message on our voicemail line, 424-255-7833, or you can send us an email, momanddad@slate.com. We need your questions to make this show. We have a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. It is the best Facebook group. There are such good conversations. It started out being all about us trying to gin up conversations about the show and stuff, and now it's a really fun community where parents are sharing their own problems and questions, triumphs and fails, even suggesting things that they want to recommend to other parents. We call that recommendations. So check it out. Go to Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. On our Slate Plus segment today, we're talking to Will Oremus. He's the host of If Then, Slate's technology podcast, and also a tech reporter at Slate. He has a classic parenting conundrum with his 3.5-year-old boy. If you want to hear us discuss that with him, you need to be a member of Slate Plus. It's just $35 for your first year. It helps cover the cost of making this show, and it's a great way to get extra segments, no ads on this or any other Slate podcast, tons of other stuff. If you're not a member, you should be a member. Slate.com/momanddadplus. If you go there, then you can sign up for Slate Plus. We will find out that you are a fan of the show. Helps everybody. Slate.com/momanddadplus. Okay, let's go. Time now to take a question from a listener. This one came to us via email. You can email us at momanddad@slate.com. It's being read for us by Slate's own Katie O'Brien.
Dear Mom and Dad Are Fighting, my husband and I have two kids, a son who is 18 months old and a daughter who is 2 months. My husband is in the military and works the midshift, which is 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., Monday night to Saturday morning. Being that he is in the military and has a hands-on, stressful job, I feel that I am never the priority. He has no say in his schedule and has a difficulty sleeping when he should sleep. Our days start with my son going to daycare and me taking care of my extremely colicky 2-month-old daughter while job hunting and trying to keep her quiet so he can sleep. He wakes up anywhere from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending on when he can get to sleep in the morning, and I pick up my son from daycare at 4 p.m. every day. Weekends are him catching up on sleep, me trying to get in some work hours with clients, and struggling to take care of two kids under the age of two who seem to tag team me. I feel like a single mom and cannot imagine doing this with a new job that my husband keeps pushing me to get. I feel as though I am spreading myself thin, taking care of the kids, cleaning, cooking, job hunting, and trying to schedule work when I can. I wake up with the baby all night long, and she is up mostly all day due to her colic. I am tired, and my husband doesn't seem to ever make me feel appreciated or feel like a real human. On top of this, the baby stresses me out so much with her constant screaming that I feel like I'm not as connected with her than my son and do not feel capable of giving her love. I try and tell my husband how I feel, but he gets mad and I don't have the energy for the argument, nor do I want our only time we spend together to be mad at each other. How do I keep my sanity with all these struggles? What can I do differently to feel better about myself and my parenting? Thanks.
I think this question is one of the saddest questions we've gotten on this show in a long time. And we get a lot of very sad questions on this show. What this writer inner is talking about, sort of wrapped in the parenting question, really is a relationship problem. Mm-hmm. Everything that you are describing points to your marriage being in trouble and you really needing to address that first and foremost. I just want to say it is not normal and not okay to not be able to tell your partner how you feel without them getting angry with you. That is the line in this question that flew out to me like a big red flag. Everything else that you're talking about, the lack of support, you doing all of the work, the pressure to get a job, the feeling overwhelmed, the inability to feel like you can connect with a really demanding and fussy baby, it all radiates from this one idea that you are right now in this alone because you don't feel like you're part of a partnership. You don't, it's not just that your partner is absent. He's actively working against a healthy situation when he is not open to the idea of even discussing your feelings of being overwhelmed. So the only thing that I can tell you to do, and I hope that you have access to a resource in this regard, and if not, I would strenuously encourage you to seek one out, reach out to your network. You need to get to counseling immediately or as soon as possible. I would say you should probably talk to somebody with your husband, and you should probably also talk to somebody on your own. Because if you are in a situation where you're faced with anger when feelings are discussed, you need some support personally on your own, in addition to addressing the issues that are clearly apparent in this relationship. That is the only place you can start. So I'm going to end my advice there because I do think that a lot of the other stuff you're talking about, that sense of being overwhelmed, the not understanding how people manage time, really that is stemming here from the fact that you are not being supported and you are doing all these things on your own and you are also managing what sounds like an incredibly difficult marriage. So get some help, please. And if you need resources, reach out to your network. If you need help finding somebody, reach out to your network. Do what you have to do to make this a healthier situation for yourself first and foremost.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that, like, when I was reading this letter, I kept imagining different stressors stacking up one on one with each sentence in this letter. And so there's like the two, there's the one kid and then there's the second kid. Both of them are at ages that are super stressful. And then there's the kid, the colic, and there's that. And then there's like this question of the husband never being around, not being able to help at night because of the work schedule. And then there's this like pressure to get a job. And then there's, you know, the continued breastfeeding. And then there's the husband not being able to hear or help with any of this stuff. That felt like a lot of things stacked up. And so my first thought, just like technically, was like, you got to remove some of these pieces that you're carrying. There's too many things. And so what can you remove? And like the job thing struck me first. I don't think you need to be looking for a job right now. That is such a huge endeavor and it takes so much time and space. And the super intense, painful, overwhelming, sort of like messy, horrific part of having two little kids, you're in the thick of it and you won't be forever. And so it seems kind of an odd time to feel like you have to somehow account for a job right now. Unless it sounds like that's like sort of something that someone is encouraged, that your husband's encouraging you to do because he maybe feels like that's going to be awesome, but doesn't seem like it's going to be. So then I started thinking when I was listening to it, like, where is this pressure coming from? And why is there this feeling that you have to do this thing? And I return to this husband and I think, this guy's not doing a great job of being a husband. I honestly feel that way. Like it's not, I understand that the work schedule makes it so that he can't be present in certain kinds of ways, but that's not the problem. The problem is when you have emotions or feelings and you need some emotional support, which even could just be in the form of listening and empathizing and understanding and just giving space for, he's not available for that. If he's getting mad at you, I mean, that's like another stressor. So like, here's kids yelling, here's breastfeeding, here's not sleeping, here's being up all night, here's looking for a job. And then here's your partner getting mad at you. That's not good. And that needs to be dealt with. And I agree with Rebecca that there needs to be like that. There's two things. One is like your husband's behavior and what needs to be done about that. But before that is like the support that you need and what needs to be done about that. That has to come first. You need support because you have too much to do and not enough support to do it. And I do think that there is a situation in which like nuclear families can become incredibly isolating, and the pressure that is put on particularly like caregiving parents in the nuclear family context can be enough to tear a whole thing apart, because there's the whole structure of it is that everything, you sort of keep everything in the house and it's not a village and everything's inside and we got to figure it out and we're this unit. And so I think that there's some advantages to that, but I think also there's a lot of increased pressure in that scenario. And I think a lot of things fall apart because of that pressure. And that's what sounds like is happening here to me. So I would say the first thing you have to do is you have to figure out how to get support for your own emotional needs in what sounds like a very tough situation. I think after that, other things may become clear about whether or not you should be with this person and whether or not this person should be trusted, or what it is you can do or what this person can do and about their own inability to be supportive to their partner. I can't imagine that this is not going to get better on its own. A lot of times with parenting stuff, I say like, well, you know, like you're in a tough patch and things are going to get better and whatever. I don't see this being that way. I think this is something you need to actively take steps in order to address. And again, that main step is getting some support for yourself because you're carrying too much right now.
Yeah. The one thing I would add to this is it's only 2 months since the baby was born. And I think you should consider the possibility that you're suffering from postpartum depression and you should get checked out for that. Talk to a doctor or a therapist or someone who's qualified to evaluate that and give you some help with that, because there's things that they can do that will not solve all of the problems that you describe in your letter, but that will maybe give you a little bit of emotional breathing space to make you feel more capable of addressing some of those problems yourself. Can be very serious and difficult, and I really strongly urge you to get that checked out. Beyond that, it seems to me like, of course, you know, as described in the letter, then it seems like your husband is not responding very well to this situation. Also, that neither of you is sleeping coherently, and that's a way in which couples can sort of plunge into some pretty bad situations together. It also seems like this is you guys are at the frayed edges of our society's failure to deal with how to take care of children and also support a family. That, you know, if you need to have two incomes in order to support yourself and you're trying to raise two children, one of them's 2 months old and you don't have a job and he has this work that keeps him out at night. And there's just no reason that we should think of this as a, like, possible situation for two humans to deal with. This just seems impossible. And if you are struggling and suffering with it, then at least you should know that it doesn't seem like something that, like, oh, if you were just a little tougher, then you would be able to make this work. It doesn't seem like a workable situation. So I don't know what changes you can make. Maybe that Carvel is right and that looking for a job or taking on client work right now is if that's something that you can dispense with in order to concentrate on taking care of yourself and your kids, then by all means do that. And get to a doctor and see what they have to say about your mental health and about the possibility of postpartum depression. I think that's all I have to tell you right now, but good luck, and I hope things do turn around.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
We've got another question from a listener. This one came to us over voicemail. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call us 424-255-7833. Let's hear this one.
Dear Mom and Dad are fighting. I need your guidance on how to handle a difficult relationship that has developed between my mother and my three-year-old. To give some background, neither of the grandparents on either side live close by. However, we see both grandparents 6 to 7 times a year because they fly in a lot to help us on when we go to business trips and they come on the holidays. There's always been a natural gravitation to my mother-in-law. When we FaceTime, he's just naturally happy to see her, brings her up in conversations, and initiates affection with her. My mother has a completely different story. While he is capable of having sweet moments with her, he can often be indifferent and more focused on what he's doing or more focused on, you know, what she buys for him than who she actually is. Now that he's in the tantruming toddler phase, he can be downright nasty to her and say, go home or go away, all of which is just devastating for her. My mom already has struggles with low self-esteem. She's incredibly sensitive and has experienced a lot of rejection in her life. Her relationship with my son almost forces her, I think, to relive that trauma of some of these crappy relationships and seems to feed that sense of worthlessness. I honestly don't know what to say anymore to her or to him. I feel horrible that she spends so much time doing sweet things for him and this relationship brings her so much heartache. I also feel it's unfair to put so much on my son because he's three, and even though he's precocious, he doesn't understand the implications of his words and his behaviors, nor is it healthy for him to be responsible for filling this void in her life. I want to be careful about projecting, but I have spent my life trying to navigate my mother's depression and self-esteem issues, and I've come a long way on this, but at times I still feel I'm responsible for her happiness, which makes this situation, which I feel I have so little control over, really stressful. The last piece is that my son also adores my dad, only sees him 2 times a year, and they often travel separately. My dad is just silly with him and in general has a larger-than-life personality, which also awed me as a kid. They're both coming for Thanksgiving, and already I'm anxious about what I should say to my son and how I should navigate my son's rejection of her. Should I ask him why he's mean to her? How should I handle it when he's rude in the past, you know, when we've talked about it? You know, I ask him how he thinks it makes her feel when he screams at her, and we write apology letters, but it doesn't feel like it gets through. I also don't know what to say to her anymore. Thanks for your help. Bye.
I mean, the short answer here is there's nothing you can do about it. He's 3 years old. He's not going to be polite.
It's not his problem.
Thanks, yeah. Thanks for going.
There's another bigger problem here that I think we need to address. But the short version of the direct answer to the specific question is, like, this is a three-year-old. Three-year-olds are sometimes rude. They're sometimes, like, differently nice to some people and then mean to other people. Nothing you can do about it. Give it a couple years. Then you can make sure that he is polite to everyone, even if he doesn't like them. But right now he's three, and that's the answer.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you're okay. So, like, there's two separate issues. One is that your kid isn't behaving the way you want them to behave, which, welcome to parenting. That's never going to stop. It's just going to be different ways in which that happens. But my experience has been that we manage and teach and learn and groom behavior over years. It's a years long process. It's a little bit like just trimming a tree or something. I've never trimmed a tree, but I'm guessing this is how it works.
Try and a car metaphor. I bet a car metaphor would work really well here. Yeah.
It's like when your flux capacitor. And so you're doing all this gardening and tending over years to create, you know, to like influence the way this person grows. And so just saying, so it takes a long time is my point. You can't just say to a three-year-old, don't be mean to grandma. And the three-year-old's like, oh, don't be mean to grandma. Got it. And then from now on, they're always polite to grandma. That's a long-term process, and that's fine, and that's normal. And I have no doubt that you're engaging in that process with efficacy and skill. And I think your kid's going to be fine. There's no reason in this letter that makes me think that they're not. The problem that you're having is that you aren't giving yourself space for that process because you have this habit of being responsible for your mother's feelings and all of her baggage, of which it sounds like there is plenty. And I don't say baggage. I mean, baggage always sounds derogatory, but I don't mean it to be derogatory. But I mean that my point is that this is stuff that she's carrying. Her feelings of rejection and no one likes me and no one gives me what I want. And I don't even know if it's true or not. But the point is, it's her stuff. And you are quite understandably, because it's your mother and there's no harder thing to separate than a mother and child. But you are making it your stuff, which means you are making it your kid's stuff. So that part is messy. And that's what's making this hard. If you were to remove that part from the equation, you'd have no problem. And that's kind of what Gabe was getting at with the short answer is like, you have a three-year-old acting like a three-year-old. That's the end of the story there. It's like not an issue. So you have to start figuring out how it is that you can disentangle yourself from your mother's stuff. And I think that, like you said in your letter, you're coming along in that process, and it's like you need to continue to go along on that process, and you need to continue to, like, let her suffer. This sounds so cruel, but it's actually what I've found to be true, that, like, a lot of times people who carry this narrative that everyone is like bad to them and everyone rejects them, and part of the thing that they do in those relationships is they try and get other people to buy in and protect and manage the world so that they don't have those feelings. And so they throw out these little conversation bombs. Well, I would feel so much better if this didn't happen, or it would be just so nice if such and such a person would do such and such a thing. And then you then take the bait, and because you now feel responsible for getting them the thing that they want. And I want to say this super duper clearly. You are not responsible for your mother's feelings.
Hmm.
Like, you're not. You're not. This is a grown person who has been on the earth for a long time. They are an adult. You are not singly responsible for this person's feelings. And you have to begin to disentangle yourself from that feeling of responsibility, because it's clouding your judgment both as a parent and as a daughter.
You could not have nailed it anymore with what you just said there. You know, she's not responsible, and I think she already knows her three-year-old's not responsible, so she's trying to shape that. The question is, like, what do you do when you have a three-year-old who at Thanksgiving is just demonstrably being more loving to one grandparent than the other? Like, this is it's a political conundrum in addition to being like a parenting and a child of an adult parent conundrum. And it reminds me of when my kids were younger, my mom and stepdad used to want them to come every summer for a week. And every summer, it was like this huge like thing where they really wanted them to come for a week. My kids would always be like, oh, it's just so boring at grandma and grandpa's house, blah, 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 blah. My mom would take it super personally. And I finally said to her one year, like, the way to get the kids to want to come to you is to be a place that kids want to go. So, like, kids are not complicated. Like, you have to just, like, stop trying to feed them black olives at every meal. Buy some sugary cereal. Like, do some actual fun activities. Like, be laid back. Let them put their feet on the couch. Like, honestly, like, you have to just accept that kids are who they are. And when you want them to come to your house and you bring them to like antiques auctions and like lunches at like the club, I mean, like, what 9-year-old wants to hang out with like 15 old people talking about like oriental rugs or whatever? Like, 0 9-year-olds want to do that. So I just sort of drew that. I sort of drew that boundary, and I said, listen, you have to like decide what kind of relationship you want to have with these kids. And it's kind of on you to be more appealing if you want them to be interested. And I'm going to let them decide. I'm not going to force them to go somewhere for a week that is going to be miserable for you, miserable for them, and that we all have to hear about the rest of the year and turn into a huge fight. Like, this is the last year. I'm going to, you know, we're going to set it up. They're going to go. But if it's not fun for them, like, I'm not going to make them go back. I'm just not going to. So that was the summer where she, instead of, you know, saying, like, we'll do all these boring things, she actually signed them up for day camps, like, near her. One of them was like a, they were like very aligned with their interests. One of them was like a robotics one, and one of them was like a cooking one. So she basically like hardly ever saw them when they were visiting, but they just got to do something super cool. And that was when it all kind of turned around. Like, it's not about me being able to take my grandkids around and show them off to people, which is very often like what, you know, some grandparents like really are into. It's about them enjoying their life and connecting it with me. It sounds manipulative, but that's actually how little kids can be, their behavior can be shaped, is by giving them positive reinforcement and positive experiences. You know, I say to my mom all the time, don't start our every phone conversation with a 20-minute treatise on the fact that we don't talk enough, because it makes me not want to talk to you. And it's only when she starts the conversation differently that I stay on the phone. And so those are the kind of boundaries you can set with your own parents, but you really just have to say to your mom at some point, because it's going to come up, listen, he's three. He's not responsible. You have to be very clear. And the reason he might like this other grandma better is because she's making it easier for him to like her better. Just relax.
It's tough, you know? Because the sense I get from this call is that the mom in question is a little ahead of where your mom was, Rebecca, with your kids. It says in the voicemail, I feel horrible that she spends so much time doing sweet things for him, and this relationship brings her so much heartache, and he only cares about what she's doing or getting for him. So this is a grandma who is at least sophisticated enough to understand, maybe if I buy them toys, then this kid will love me. Maybe if I do this for him, maybe if I do that for him. I think what he's responding to is not that she's trying to take him to the club and talk about rugs with her friends. What this kid is responding to,
which sounds awesome, by the way.
Which sounds super cool.
I would be super into that at 9, but that's just me.
Yeah. What this 3-year-old is responding to, I suspect, is not the fact that it's all boring and old people. He's responding to the fact that what he gets from his grandmother is her own neediness and desperation.
Her angst. Yeah, totally.
Like that, those people whose response to the world is like anxious need and like narcissistic need, those are not people who make other people feel happy and comfortable being around them. And when you're a 3-year-old boy, you don't have any strategies for like, well, here's what I do to keep this person basically comfortable and make us have an okay time. All you know is like, this person makes me feel bad and anxious and nervous and bad, and I just want to get away from her, and I want her to go away and go home. And that's what you say because you're 3 years old. And it's very hard to say that to your mom. You can say to your mom, like, sign him up for camp and don't make him go to the club with you. But it's very hard to say, try not to be such a quivering ball of despairing need, because, like, that, how can you say that to your mom? And even if you could, what would she take from it?
Don't we want our kids to, I mean, we say all the time, like, we want our kids to be able to stay away from situations that make them uncomfortable. We want them to be able to communicate with us about their boundaries. We want them to avoid adults who make them feel weird. And for some reason, we keep forcing them in our own families to be with adults who make them feel weird. And I think that it is a gift you could give your kids when you say, if you don't like spending time with this adult, if it makes you uncomfortable, if it makes you unhappy, like, it's, I will help you draw that boundary in some ways, and not try to force it, not try to give this grandma equal time until she figures her stuff out. Like, he should be allowed to draw that boundary. I don't care that he's three. Like, if it was a creepy neighbor who you felt weird about, and your kid was like, you wouldn't think a second about drawing that boundary.
But that would be because you were worried that the creepy neighbor was gonna like harm the kid. Whereas in this case, what you're worried about is
emotional harm. I'm sorry, there's some emotional harm that can come from this kind of relationship. It's toxic.
Mean,
it is toxic.
Yeah, but don't we all have to hang out with people who make us feel bad sometimes? Like, as adults, we certainly do.
Mm. We do, but we also get to draw boundaries around how we want those relationships to look.
Yeah,
don't
so
we?
This is actually, I think, one of the like weird kind of cleaving points of where we are as a society, because I think that we all grew up being told in no uncertain terms that we had to spend time with relatives that made us uncomfortable, and like that was like, and that was like not only a duty but kind of a moral duty, and you have to deal with it, and I know your uncle's weird, but just hang out with him and just whatever. And so I think that we still carry some of that, and I think that quite rightfully people have begun to say, hold up, stop that on all levels. That is a fundamental thing, and it's not just about safety, physical safety, which is what kind of like the neighbor example is about, but it also is about, on a more important level, it's about teaching kids to respect and care for their own internal sense of safety and not to run. I think it's about knowing how to have a little more calibrated nuance about running roughshod over the will of kids and about the way in which we learn to run roughshod over our own will and sense of safety and et cetera. And so I think that as a society, we're collectively being like, well, maybe actually, kind of like what Rebecca's saying, like, well, maybe actually we're supposed to be taking these feelings of discomfort more seriously and respecting them and honoring them, as opposed to the old school approach, which is like, look, it's going to be tough out there. You got to just suck it up sometimes. You got to teach people how to suck it up. I think that we're just sort of stuck in that. That's where we are kind of collectively as an evolution. And like, I feel that I myself was raised very much with the suck it up, suck it up, suck it up. That was like the message about every single thing. And I've not only was that the message, but I also view that as a valuable strategy. And I can even look back and say, it's so great that I sucked it up there. And it's so great how I was in that terrible situation. I navigated through it there by just sucking it up and walking it off and breathing the air and whatever. And I can look at that and say, that was awesome. But what I can sit down with my therapist and discover is like, there are also ways in which my suck it up methodology has like made it impossible for me to know what I truly feel. And that has put me actually in dangerous situations with people. That has like allowed me to let people in my life who are actually shitty people, but I didn't quite realize it, because when my little internal sensor was like, something's off, I'm not sure I like this person, I'm not sure I want to be around them, I was like, it's fine, suck it up, they're fine, it's great, it's fine, get over it. So I think that there's like, you know what I'm saying? So I think that there is something really valuable about what Rebecca's saying, and I just want to call out that I'm like each day evolving even more and more towards that.
It's really interesting, and it's I think it's great that we have extrapolated from this narrow situation about a boy and his grandmother to the bigger stuff that you're talking about yourself and about our society. And yet, in terms of what you would say to this specific mother with this specific 3-year-old and these specific problems with her own mother, I kind of want to say, definitely don't make the kid have any feelings that he doesn't have. Definitely, the goal is not to punish the 3-year-old for responding very naturally to a grandmother who makes him feel bad. At the same time saying, well, if your grandmother makes you feel bad, maybe you never have to see her and maybe she's never going to come over again. I don't know that that's necessarily the right thing to do in this situation. I think maybe the right thing to do in this situation is, grandma's coming over because grandma comes over and she's not going to hurt you. But if you don't like being around her and you want to run away or you want to shout at her or whatever, then you're not going to get a punishment for that, and I'm not going to discourage it necessarily.
Be as nice as you can be, is what I would say. But I would say also, yeah, when my kids get older, I mean, I've let my kids choose the kind of relationship they want to have with each of their grandparents. And each of them have chosen very different kinds of relationships with each of their grandparents. And that feels right to me because I didn't get a choice as to whether or not to have a relationship with these people. Like, I was born, but like, they do have a choice. And some of those relationships, I think they're doing a very good job navigating. I mean, sometimes I'm like, oh, it would be nice if you sent one more thank you note or whatever. But like, I can help with those boundaries. And I don't think this mother should say that to her kid. I think she can just help facilitate the boundaries and just not make him feel like he has to carry any of this generational baggage around.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's time now for the part of the show where we recommend things to you. We're still figuring out what to call it. Right now I'm thinking we'll call it recommendations.
What's the etymology of the word recommendation?
It's from the Latin, res commendere, which is to speak highly of a thing. You asked. You fucking asked.
But actually.
It doesn't count if you ask. I get to answer.
You do, Professor.
What are you going to recommend, Rebecca?
Well, my recommendation is actually a series of tips that I just wrote down in response to something somebody put on our Mom and Dad Are Fighting Facebook group, which is awesome, by the way. I love those people.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody put a post this week about like they're just starting to teach their teenager how to drive. The teenager's also going to be taking driver's ed. And this parent was just like, what do I do? Where do I start? What do I do? So my recommendation is just a couple of very simple tips. Let the driving instructor do the shit that you have learned to do for yourself and have like your way of doing it or anything that is difficult or causes angst. So, for example, let your kid's driving instructor teach them how to park, parallel park, back into parking spaces, which for some reason is like an important skill that you only learn in driver's ed. All those granular things, sort of those weird, obscure signs that you never actually see. Don't worry about that. You teach your kid how to control the car, keep it in its lane, go the right speed, how to get places, how to properly sort of really stop at a stop sign, roll forward a little bit, look left, right, left, and go. Lane control, speed, that is the stuff you should focus on when teaching your kid. Just the basic fundamentals of cars are not scary. It's okay to drive them around. Let the professional handle all the other stuff. Trust me, it will make your time in your car with your teenager much better when you're just focusing on the fundamentals of just controlling a car. And seriously, let someone else teach your kid how to parallel park. Just, I just can't tell you to trust me enough on this. Let someone else do it. Because the way you do it, I promise, is not the way it is being taught. And it is not going to help them when they try to pass that driver's test.
All right. I'm going to recommend a TV show that you should absolutely not, under no circumstances, watch with your child. Even if your child is 17 years old and is old enough to enjoy this TV show, let them enjoy it by themselves, and you enjoy it by yourself. But you may find that it gives you more insight into the struggle of your child, especially if your child is around the age of puberty. The show is called Big Mouth. It's on Netflix. It's an animated series. It's by Nick Kroll and some other people. I just got into it the other day, thanks to my colleague Laura Bennett, who recommended it to me, and Jack Hamilton, who wrote a great piece about it on Slate.com. It's a show about kids who were in, I guess, seventh grade or sixth grade and who were just hitting puberty, and the physical changes and the ways they experienced these physical changes in terms of their relationships. It made me, for the first time, incredibly nervous about what's down the road for me with my kids, who the older one being a few years away from puberty now. But it also, I felt like it gave me some insight into like, oh my God, your whole body just like it goes nuts and the hormones and your whole personality changes. And it gave me a different perspective on all this stuff that's coming up. And it's also really funny and I heartily recommend it. Big Mouth on Netflix. How about you, Carvel?
Yeah, I just want to say my kids love Big Mouth. They think it's one of the greatest shows ever made. And they both view themselves as amateur TV critics. And they are adamant that Big Mouth is really good. And so I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it, but I just want to like second your recommendation. So I'm going to recommend I've been wanting to recommend this for a while, but I haven't quite. I've just been lurking on it, trying to figure out if I think this is a good recommendation or not. But I'm going to go ahead and pull the trigger on it. It's an Instagram channel called, are you ready for this? If You High. And it's about, it's literally things that are amazing to look at if you're high. And the thing that's interesting to me about it is that I'm not high, generally. I'm just not a high person. But kids are like they're high, and some of the stuff in there is just fascinating to watch. And it took me back to my old days when my kids were little, and I would just show them just any cool thing I could find on YouTube and on the internet. And I'd just be like, look at this, you know, like, look at this person making paper, or like, look at this, like, long video of, like, a polar bear, like, walking down a hill, you know, and the kid would just sort of, like, sit and stare. And If You High is not 100% perfect. Some of the stuff is just only interesting if you're a stoner, and but some of the stuff on there is fascinating. So what I recommend is that you just follow on Instagram the If You High channel, and then see if and there you may find every once in a while one of every 10 things is just something that's like truly beautiful and fascinating to watch. A lot of times it's process videos, things taking place at factories, kind of like reminds me of what they used to have on like Sesame Street when they'd be like, now we're at the paper factory.
Oh,
and they do
that.
All the like weird machinery and shit, which I loved. And there's some stuff like that. And sometimes it's nature stuff, and sometimes it's people painting but doing amazing things. And sometimes it's weird perspective stuff where someone will like make a sculpture, but then the camera will move and you'll realize that it's this like 3D kinetic thing. And so it's all this stuff that basically is for like college age stoners to be like, whoa, that is so trippy. But so I wouldn't say like encourage your kids to follow it, because some of it is just dumb. But I would say that you follow it, and then every once in a while you'll find something that's like truly beautiful and amazing to look at, and you'll want to show it to your kids. So the Instagram channel is If You High.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm completely mesmerized. Completely mesmerized.
So those are our parenting recommendations, our some driver's tips, an obscene cartoon, and an Instagram channel for stoners. And that's our show. If you have a question that you want us to address, give us a call, 424-255-7833. Sign up for our Facebook group. Go to Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. People there will be discussing this episode, sharing their own triumphs and fails, solving one another's problems, or perhaps exacerbating them. Go on Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. Our show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we'll see you next week.